Since 2011, American Giant has been making everyday clothing with extraordinary effort. Not in far-off factories, but right here in the USA. We obsess over fabrics, fit, and details, because if you're going to wear it every day, it should feel great and last for years. From the cut of a hoodie to the finishing of a seam, nothing is overlooked. Our supply chain is tight-knit and local, which means less crisscrossing the country and more care in every step. The result is durable clothing, t-shirts, hoodies, sweatpants, and denim that become part of your life season after season. This isn't fast fashion, it's clothing made with purpose by people who care as much about how it's made as how it fits. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Down to Business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland
on News Talk.
So, I told you we were going to talk about the stories of the week and the weekend. My esteemed panel is here in the shape of Caroline Reedy of the HR Suite and Larkin Allen of Keating and Associates. Good morning, one and all.
Morning, Bobby.
Morning, Bobby.
Now, Larkin, we might start with you. An interesting headline in the Irish Independent today, which would have seemed contrary to advice we would have had in the past, but we've been advised to keep small stash of cash at home for use in emergencies, households to be advised. So clearly the threat of cyber, of a cyber threat is greater than one of a burglary.
Yeah, that's right, Bobby. Really interesting story here this morning by John Burns in the Irish Independent. He's got details of a study from the European Central Bank called Keep Calm and Carry Cash. And I suppose the findings of it are interesting, but then not surprising in that human nature can be quite predictable. So during COVID-19, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, the financial crash in Greece, and most recently, I suppose, the power outage in Spain and Portugal, the ECB could see large spikes in consumers going to ATMs to get cash during those crises because, you know, they're feared for...
That's if they were working.
Yes, yes. So that they feared about their digital, devices being down or card payment systems being down. So to have cash to try and pay for essentials during crises like that. So reflecting on that, I think the ECB is sort of advising now that we should maybe keep a small stock of cash at home for such emergencies, which would be somewhat contrary to previous advice that you shouldn't be keeping cash at home because of security risks. So it's interesting that, you know, we've had a lot of these kind of major macro crises and situations, and the ECB is obviously learning from that now and saying...
Well, one of my daughters who's in Barcelona was there for the recent outage, and she told me that the biggest problem was that the ATMs weren't working and people couldn't get cash.
Yeah,
and no one could get home from the city.
Scary concept, though. And I think that really shocked everybody to think, well, actually, we're so dependent on tapping our card rather than having cash. And I definitely think not alone are people having the cash, but they're also thinking, remember Storm Owen last January when people were housebound, etc. Now people are thinking the power banks, I think, all went up on sale as well. And, you know, all those kind of things. So people would be better prepared. So good and timely, I think, with the weather starting to disimprove. But I think the big power outages in Spain last year definitely has really got us all thinking, you know, to have a backup plan.
And we must end the story on a good news piece because we must remember, do you remember the American football game in the Aviva when the tills freebies crashed and they gave out the beer?
The dream scenario for everybody.
Let's go back to those days.
Lucky it wasn't in Croke Park and All-Ireland final day.
For Oasis.
Now, forcing tech terms to vet ads for fraud could harm US ties, Larkin. I don't know about this as a story. It's clearly we're all very, you know, we're mindful of the income channel that's driven by foreign direct investment. And there's some quarters in government who don't want to upset that.
Yeah, the Department of Enterprise has kind of reacted quite negatively to proposals by the Department of Finance saying that tech companies should be asked to vet any financial ads being put on their platforms on Facebook, Instagram, X, Google, TikTok, or whatever. And the Department of Enterprise is saying, well, this is, it's going to damage our reputation internationally. A warning we hear regularly about anything that is when we're proposing changes for the tech firms. I don't know. I look at this and go, surely a minimum standard of vetting these financial ads is hardly a big ask.
I mean, some of these
ads are so sophisticated, these scams now, what they're able to do and trick people into it. I mean, it's hardly a big ask for those companies to vet these things.
Caroline, let's move on to the housing was the big story of last week. Cliff Taylor's piece in today's Irish Times, you know, again, the way he writes, he talks about Kate, a single person on 65k, and basically how it's going to affect her.
And
it really is interesting when you look at, I suppose, a scenario such as this, and you put it alongside the complexity of the housing crisis and the issue. It's interesting to see his narrative.
Yeah, he's done a great job, as always, in fairness to Cliff. But in this particular story, he uses Kate, as you say, as his case study. Kate is basically earning a decent income of 65 grand. She has built up savings of 110,000. And he's saying, based on the stats, she can afford a second-hand house at about 370,000. She will qualify for some of the state supports in place, which are the Help to Buy scheme, which offers a tax refund of up to 30 grand, and the First Home scheme, where she can borrow up to 100,000 then if she gets that 30%
So that allows her basically buy a house for 500 grand.
500 grand, yeah, up to that. But what he's saying, and he's dead right, to do that though,
she has to move to Carlow.
She has to go
or
somewhere like that, which means she'll be part of the commute, which means everything else is obviously putting pressure on the infrastructure. But I suppose what also, I suppose, this highlights is ultimately the housing plan that is in place, it's not meeting the demand. Like, we know that for every house Kate is going to go to see, there's going to be a queue of other people gazumping and paying more than what, you know, she needs, if that is the case. So I think demand and infrastructure and overall the need, this housing plan, I suppose, as described by Dermot O'Leary, the economist in Goodbody, is evolution rather than revolution. And I think it's a really good and apt descriptor, because that's what it is. It's a nudge in the right direction, but it's not going to do enough in reality.
Larkin, I saw other commentary saying that it almost is a good thing that the housing plan is kind of the same as the last one, in terms of that we're not, you know, that we actually don't need a new plan. We just need to implement the old plan.
Yeah, and like that's the thing for people who work in the sector. I mean, they're trying to, if suddenly the government tore up the entire playbook and went totally radical, they have to start from scratch as well. And we've even seen that with some, like, I've heard anecdotal evidence of apartments that maybe have been given planning permission, and then there was changes around the apartment guidelines, and now they're sort of saying, maybe we'll hold back from actually starting to work on these, because it would be more in our interest to wait. The problem with housing is, you know, there's long lead times in the delivery of it. So the government is going to have patience and sort of, as Matt Cooper points out, just sort of, and both Cliff Taylor points out, is like, have patience to see this through and hope that it works, because the level of state intervention now in the housing system is unprecedented, and they have to make sure it works.
Yeah, Matt Cooper's piece is interesting. Again, housing is it's a terribly complex piece, but he simplifies in giving us, I suppose it's, eight key points around what we could have had and what we actually got. One of the things I didn't actually realise was that he talks about the reality, as Craig Hughes reveals in the Irish Mail last Monday, there are 45,000 units with planning permission granted where not a brick has been laid.
Yeah.
So, you know, you need to get into the reasons behind that, clearly.
I know of one very large development project on the north side of the city where they have planning permission for 800 units, a really, really well thought out development. But in the kind of time it took to get planning, the interest rates moved, and then the government introduced the rent cap, which totally changed the economics of that development for the company behind it. And that's sitting there now because the economics of building that does not make sense at the minute.
Yeah.
So that's the thing.
You know, and, you know, in simple terms, you know, no one is going to get involved in something that will knowingly lose money.
Exactly,
why would you?
Absolutely. I think it's also interesting, Bobby, where he reminds us that the government has abandoned the annual rates. And like we all know, it's grand to say this is the plan to have the 300 homes by 2030.
Yeah, that sort of says that they can't be beaten up over being held to a figure, which is not really a great idea.
No, and I think even for themselves, I think if you are standing behind this plan to say we're going to achieve it, put in annual targets so that for everybody who's working on this project, they know that they're on track. Because as we said, it probably is modest overall in terms of what we need to achieve. But I definitely think they need to maybe reassess that. I don't think that's acceptable, really, when, you know, it's such a high priority for the economy right
now.
Yeah,
no, I think I'm with you on that. Well, I have you there, Caroline. I know this is a subject that you'll be very interested in. The pager in the business section of the Examiner, hybrid working is in decline as large employers push staff back to the office, is one story I wanted to look at. And I also wanted to look at a piece in The Independent, which references Dennis O'Brien's recent commentary on this matter. Dennis O'Brien's bee in his bonnet about remote work, Lark, isn't backed by data. So we might start with the Examiner piece. You know, as somebody who's close to this area, would you accept that recruiters are reporting a sharp decline in hybrid roles? Is that actually happening?
I think definitely, Bobby. I think a lot of organisations, small and medium-sized organisations maybe based outside of Dublin, are still recruiting hybrid and remote as a competitive advantage in an effort to try and get people, you know, that maybe ordinarily they wouldn't capture other than offering very good flexibility and hybrid and remote. But ultimately, I would say a lot of the major big firms, like we've seen JP Morgan, Amazon, TikTok, the list goes on, where they've absolutely mandated people to come back into the office. Ultimately, they realise by doing that, that they're going to lose a percentage of their workforce, because people have adjusted their lives now to a new life's model. They're living in Kerry and they're coming up to Dublin one day a week and they're fine to do that.
And there's no way, there's no going back to the old way once you experience that.
Absolutely. And the cost, I suppose, the cost of living that they now experience outside of Dublin, and the time they save, like think the commute, I think, and the infrastructure around, you know, commuting in Dublin is such a challenge still. But ultimately, you know, I suppose Dennis O'Brien has sparked a new conversation. But we've seen with the banks recently, AIB and Bank of Ireland, where they've both been in the headlines, you know, encouraging people to be, well, insisting more than encouraging that people come back. But what those banks have done and others are doing too is looking at putting hubs more regionally based as well for companies, you know, in that regard.
Lorcan, I don't know what your thoughts around this whole matter are, but the bit that kind of intrigues me is that so many of these businesses haven't downsized offices. There's so many offices not being used to their potential, with full rents being paid on. Like, to me, if there was a massive gain for a business by having people work remote and not having the head office cost associated with, then everybody's winning. But there's so many companies don't seem to have bitten the bullet on the, or maybe can't because of contractual obligations to leases, etc. But it just seems until that gain is realised, I don't think they're willing to pass that gain onto the employees.
Yeah, it is. Like, we're still, I think, seeing the evolution of where hyperworking is going. I mean, I think what's holding a lot of companies back is, yeah, they're in contracts for long-term leases or whatever. I've seen some kind of examples of companies where they've moved, downsized, and trying to consolidate into something that's more fit for purpose. But it hasn't been a mass take-up of it. I think Mike Murphy from CareerWise makes a good point in the Examiner article he's quoted there, saying about a lot of companies are insisting on new starters coming in and being in the office because they want to train them up and get them familiar. But once people get their feet under the desk, get to know their management, there is then opportunities where there's a bit of trust built up there that you can maybe go for more flexibility. Rich Kern makes a really good point in his piece in The Independent that we all view this through our own lens, and Dennis Bryan does too, obviously. And I'm sure Dennis is thinking over his career where the mentors he had and worked with him in the office. I'm the same. My career, the start of it was always office based, and I think back of all the foundation or all the mentors I had over the years, and just, you know, sitting down over lunch and things like that. And that's something that maybe young people who are only starting their career, they're probably not aware that there's a trade-off there, that you're not sitting down with maybe a senior partner or a senior person at lunchtime and learning from them because you're at home. And that's very difficult to measure in data.
Yeah.
But the data does show that, you know, productivity is very high from people working home because they get stuff done at home and they're less distracted. It's probably the trade-off is that silence, you know, your career development maybe is what you're missing.
It's funny, the stats are actually not great. We don't have great stats to measure. Are people more productive at home or are they more productive?
There's a lot
in the
of
office?
Anecdotal stuff
loads,
around us.
Yeah. Loads of it. But also, I suppose, you're missing the bits maybe. Like, how do you measure collaboration? How do you measure innovation, learning by osmosis, people building a network so that they can pick up the phone and, you know, ask for the quick favour because they know the relationships. Definitely, there's also the piece around loneliness. We've never been lonelier because people aren't getting that office experience, you know, or that collegial experience maybe as they did before. But one thing's for sure, it's a definite seismic shift back in the last 12 months that we, you know, a lot of people said, well, remote and flexible is here to stay. I think flexible is definitely here to stay. But I do think we're seeing more 3 days in than the 2 days we started the year with.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, we'll continue to monitor it because it is it's a very, very interesting space. Looking at the US and Wall Street, Lorcan, Joe Brennan has a very interesting piece. He says that the small investors who propelled Wall Street, the Wall Street rally, are now showing signs of wavering. And this is really very interesting about how the S&P 500 is trading at all-time highs, how we should be. Maybe there are some real indications out there that a bust is coming. And also the impact of retail investors and how significant they are now as a cohort that were really not represented in any real scale in the past.
Yeah, you know, it's a very good piece by Joe, trying to kind of a macro look at the markets. I mean, anybody looking at the US stock market over the last while, probably scratching their heads a little bit how it just keeps continuing to grow and grow and grow. I mean, there's been many people warning of overinflation in valuations of stocks and prices due to AI predominantly, but it has kept it has continued to grow. And interesting, Joe Brennan points out that 30% of all stocks trades in the US now are all retail investors, which is, you know, driven by they can trade on
and
their phones.
This is Joe or Jane with his investment on his phone, basically doing his...
rather than have to call up a stockbroking firm, that they can do it on their phone. And they are having, and we've seen that with some of the certain sort of meme stocks, as they're known, where company retail investors plow money into stocks that look to be dead and buried, and they'll revive them, and there's insane valuations. So anyone looking at the financial markets, it is very difficult to find to sort of figure out, because the valuations for the tech firms like Nvidia and related to AI do seem very overinflated. But yeah, I was in Virginia last week, which is data center valley of the US, and the amount of money and investment going into building infrastructure, digital infrastructure to fuel the AI boom is unprecedented.
Yeah.
So you can see where the money is going, and they're building the capacity there. So there is something, I would feel I can see what's behind that.
Just a couple of other sensors in there, Caroline. Warren Buffett now having almost a third of all their investments in cash is one, let's call it red flag. Also, there's Michael Burry, the US hedge fund manager. He earned more than $800 million for investors by speculating against subprime mortgage bonds during 2008. So he's another guy to be watched.
Absolutely.
And he has a view.
He has. And Barry is basically saying that, you know, some of the AI firms in Nevada and other places, you know, he's seeing this as a huge opportunity. And the interesting thing about it is AI and tech, now 25% of all the companies, you know, it's down to a few small companies. I suppose also we have to think about it, that every Irish person now with pension auto enrollment kicking in on the 1st of January is going to have their pension invested into stocks like
that's
these.
That's a very good point.
So we're all going to be a little bit more interested in the pensions, because whether it's a bubble or not, the question continues, I think.
Sure. Silver Pail Dairies, interesting results, that this is a business that was in trouble.
Brilliant.
Entered examinership, new owners. They seem to have made a good fist of it, Larkin.
They have, yeah, great turnaround. Silverpale Dairies for their 24 financial year reported pre-tax profits of almost 1.3 million. They're the biggest ice cream manufacturer in the country down in Fermoy in County Cork. And the guys who bought that business out of receivership have really done a good job turning it around and sort of getting the business back on track. What is interesting now, and I'd be interested to see next year's results, is, you know, the year that they did enter receivership, it was 21-22, and that was when there was record milk prices. 25 has been a year of record milk prices as well, and obviously milk is the key ingredient for making ice cream. So I'd say this year may have been somewhat, you know, more tangible, but it does seem to have done a great job of turning that business around.
Also, what was interesting to me, Carlin, was that these three lads who are in this business, Paul and Niall Condon and Steve Dwyer, they came from another business. They sold their classic drinks business to Palace Foods. That's right. So, you know, it's a really good example of guys cashing out, going again, buying, maybe seeing an opportunity of a business that was in trouble, and then reorganizing it to add value.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a great news story. And like 100 jobs were involved in this as well. So I suppose it's a great example of examinership and receivership going well. But it also shows you, I suppose, having people who have good experience, they know what to do, which I think really has paid off here as well. But also, I suppose, Tesco is their biggest customer, and they've launched new products for the retailer this year. So innovation, etc., going on. So I'm with Larkin, looking forward to watching this one continue. But a really positive, good news story for sure.
Larkin, Japan leader's sleep schedule prompts concerns over work-life balance. This lady was having meetings at 3 a.m., convening aides in advance of an appearance before Parliament. There seems to be a bit of a debate about, I think she only sleeps 2 hours a night. This lady has a lot of energy, but not everybody works at the same pace.
Considering we've just talked about remote working and hybrid working, and she's this is a totally different story at the other end of the spectrum. Yeah, this is Japan's new Prime Minister, Sane Takachi, gathered a meeting in 3M with her aides ahead of a budget meeting that morning at 9 a.m. in Japan. What I found the most interesting thing about this is she said that she called a meeting because her fax machine wasn't working at home.
Fax is still
a big technology in Japan. So the image of Japan as a leading edge technology, I'm questioning that now if they're still using fax.
What was your take on this, Caroline?
A 3-hour meeting at 3 a.m. in the morning, and ultimately it sounds like as if it was just for another standard meeting the next day. But interestingly, they said it was particularly sensitive because there have been high profile cases in recent years of death from overwork. So it seems like a very serious issue over in Japan, which definitely we're lucky with our very strong employment protections here. No one has to worry about.
All right, well, we'll have to leave it there. A big thanks to my business review panel, Caroline Reedy of the HR Suite, and Larkin Allen of Keating & Associates. Thanks for joining us. Enjoy your weekend, folks.
Down to business with Bobby Kerr.
Brought to you by Bank of Ireland.
Saturday morning at 11 on News Talk.
With the state of today's economy, it is more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made of the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back into your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality made to last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.